welcome to the Tom and Curly Show, this Friday edition. I, of course, am Tom Tangney, and John Curly, of all people, isn't away. You know, John Curly always busts me for not being around on the holidays, and I always take my holiday vacations off, and he always works. So I'm happy to return the favor. John, where the heck are you? This is the day before the holiday, and you're already gone. I think we all know, if you're regular listeners to the show, John is in Cle Elum right now, in his cabin, preparing for a Thanksgiving feast on some kind of table that he is going to construct with pulleys that'll raise the roof, in effect, put the table up on the ceiling. He'll lower it for a nice, I don't know, candlelit dinner with his son, Rye. But anyway, John is taking off the holiday and even a day early, and well wishes to you, John. Happy Thanksgiving. And you know what? Those of you still listening to the Tom and Curly Show, we have nothing to fear because we have a great co-host. It's time to cue his music.
Let's go. I love the L.A. women. I crave the Georgia peaches. The camel skin tones of the women down in Miami.
That's right, we've got Dre's again, a great conversationalist, direct from a beautiful blue-skied Los Angeles, I noticed this morning during our pre-show. I'm kind of jealous, although it's a gorgeous day here in the Pacific Northwest, too, for a change.
You know what? Don't be jealous, Tom. I would love to be in Seattle right now. If it was not for COVID, I would be in Seattle right now. And you're right. Every time I come on this show, John, when you're not here, oh, my gosh, he literally goes in on you. I love it.
He just rails on me. So turnabout is fair play, I guess. Well, we have actually a lot to hear from and to talk about this this Friday show. Even though it's really a Wednesday, to me it feels like a Friday. The issue is, how are we going to be spending our Thanksgiving? This is Thanksgiving 2020. This is our COVID-era Thanksgiving. And to warm us up, we're going to hear from the president-elect. Now, we had heard, Dre's, the kind of the scuttlebutt before. We heard that the president-elect was going to have a Thanksgiving Day message, and it was going to be sort of this formal, proceedings. And there were some early indications that it was going to be a kind of a grim assessment of where we stand. Instead, and I think this is all just sort of set up to trick us, instead, it was an incredibly upbeat Joe Biden. We are going to work together. We're the greatest country. I think he even threw in the idea that we're going to cure cancer and Alzheimer's at the same time. We can do anything. So here is a bit of an upbeat Joe Biden.
You know, looking back over our history, you see that it's been in the most difficult circumstances that the soul of our nation has been forged. And now we find ourselves again facing a long, hard winter. For so many of us, it's hard to hear this fight isn't over. And we still have months of this battle ahead of us. For those who have lost a loved one, I know that this time of year can be especially difficult. Believe me, I know. I remember that first Thanksgiving, the empty chair, the silence, takes your breath away. It's really hard to care. It's hard to give thanks. It's hard to even think of looking forward. And it's so hard to hope. I understand.
Okay, well, that wasn't the most upbeat clip. I think, though, it's sort of a somber Joe, but he worked it up. I don't know how long it was, maybe a 10-minute speech, but it was all sort of like, we can do this. It was sort of like what you might expect when you're facing, the troubles of World War II. We're going to make it through this. The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. But he did come off as, you know, a unifier. He tries to, I think, establish himself as someone who is not part of the petty jealousies from party to party, the kind of rivalry you'd expect from, sort of the winner of a bitter contest. I mean, after all, he did get more votes than any president in the history of the United States. But his opponent, the present president, President Trump, he got more votes, I think, than anybody he's ever gotten as well. So we are a divided nation. And Joe Biden, at least right now, is trying to say that we are the United States of America. Are you buying any or all of it, Dres?
I'm buying everything he's selling right now. And I'll tell you why. I typically would not be such a Joe Biden guy, but he's winning me over in this. I was not a Biden fan, but
yeah.
He's winning me over because it seems like he gets it, right? He understands more so where we are. To take a speech like this and go really high, right, where you're talking about we can do it and all these great things, and then to grab a captivating moment about, like, being around the table and there's someone missing, there's a lot of people who are missing family members. I know people who have lost people to COVID. And so to grab this moment where there's so many different things being felt, it sucks in so many ways. And for me, what I like is he's just slowly taking the attention off of, it's almost like the volume is slowly being turned down on the president. Like, it's just, we're just slowly muting him and we're turning the volume up on Biden. And I love it, right? Because it's connecting to me because it's a voice that we need. People need hope. And he's giving us kind of a little dose of everything that we need.
Yeah, I wonder right now, I think you're dialing down the kind of the vociferous volume that we've gotten used to over the last 4 years with President Trump. I wonder if as he's tuning that down, he's also tuning down the interest meter that we have in him and what he's up to. the interest meter in Joe Biden. I mean, I think I've heard this before that, welcome to the return to blandness that it seemed for the last 4 years, whether you love Trump or hate Trump, that every moment of our waking lives was focused on the president. Either he was outraging you or he was cheering, you on. Yeah, we need somebody to, punch federal bureaucracy in the nose. And it was like he was the center of attention. He can't help himself. Maybe that's what we thought we wanted, somebody to shake up the system. But the nice thing is maybe with 4 years under Biden, and I'm sure we're going to have all sorts of hellacious political battles with the Biden administration, especially if the Senate stays in Mitch McConnell's hands. But still, it might be nice if we can kind of focus our attention away from, the battles, the pitched battles we've been seeing out of the White House, and instead go back to our normal lives and, maybe a kind of a Biden presidency will be sort of a boring presidency. I remember, so I'm old enough to remember I was a little kid at the time when JFK was first running it, and that was, we were a Catholic family at Dre's, and so it was John F. Kennedy, oh my God, a Catholic could actually be, win the presidency. It was so exciting for us at the time, and the contrast was with those boring Eisenhower years, like nothing really happened over the 50s. We were just successful, but kind of boring. I think we're kind of, now that we have, I think Joe Biden is only the second Catholic president we've ever had, maybe he's going to return to the Eisenhower years, which in retrospect now look like they were the wonder years, but at the time they said, oh, it's so boring, nothing really as much is happening until this exciting new JFK. I think we'd yearn for the good old boring days of an Eisenhower and or a Joe Biden.
Listen to me. Boring has never been more sexy. Are you kidding me? I don't need any seasoning salt on my food. I want it boring. I want nothing. You know what I mean? Like just, suit pants and simple, right? Nothing flashy. No Nikes, no swoosh on the side. I want sneakers, not even tennis shoes, just sneakers. Give me boring, man.
Well, then Biden's your man.
That's my guy. It's sexy. Give me boring.
So before today, so that's the newest, the freshest sound from I keep wanting to say vice president. He's the president-elect right now. But before that, he gave his first interview post the election with Lester Holt from NBC. And he talked about the fact that in this effort at trying to unify the country, that he very well may nominate a Republican to his cabinet.
Selecting or nominating a Republican, someone who voted for President Trump?
Yes, and we still have a lot more appointments to make. I want this country to be united. The purpose of our administration is once again united. We can't keep this virulent political dialogue going. It has to end.
There you go. So it's a more unifying blandness, which is right what the doctor ordered, or what Dre's ordered at least. Now, let's get to one of the tricky things. Did you want to say something? You can jump in anytime here, Dre.
Yeah, well, I just want to say I heard the interview and I didn't buy it, right? I will say this.
Okay.
I didn't buy it. If you listen to the interview, it sounded like, what else could he say when they asked the question? The way he stepped over that yes, if you can really hear the whole soundbite, he was stepping over that yes to get to a maybe, right? Which is really a no, right? He talked about everything else he had done. Nothing quite sounded like, so that, well, this is the first thing I can say where you're telling me you want to work with people across the aisle, but you don't really want anyone from the other aisle in your office.
Okay, so. Now that's, I love this, the parsing of this. So that's great. As long as you've raised this. I think he did. To me, it wasn't a full-throated hurrah, of course I will. Because, I credit Lester Holt with this question. He didn't say nominate a Republican. He said nominate a Republican who voted for Trump. Mm-hmm. Now, see, there were a whole swath of traditional, moderate or mainstream Republicans who attacked, John Kasich. John Kasich would easily fit into Trump cabinet because he's a very moderate, reasonable. I mean, he has, on the social issues, he's a very, strict Christian in all of this. So it's not like he's, not even recognizable within the Republican Party, but he came out very early on in the election campaign and said, listen, I will not vote for Trump. Trump does not represent what Republicans, should be offering. So there are a nice swath of former Republicans that he could easily nominate. But for Lester Holt to then stick it to him by saying, okay, a Republican who voted for Trump, and you're right, Dres, a Republican who voted for Trump, that will help unify the Trump voter, that didn't vote for Biden. Instead, I think he was looking for an easy out and saying, see, I'm magnanimous. I might even put two Republicans. Tom Ridge, the former Homeland Security guy, he came out and was pretty strong against some of Trump's policies. They didn't give him that out. We need to find a Democrat that he can work with. I mean, a Republican that he can work with that voted for Trump. Good luck.
There was definitely a frog in the throat moment. I'm telling you, I watched it and I said, oh boy, there it is right there. That's it. You're not quite ready to. He didn't expect that question, so he kind of stumbled over it. But everything else sounded good. But yeah, that's the part I was like, he's not ready to do that.
So. That's good. Well, see, and that's good. It's good to have, as much as you and I are hoping that the Biden administration will be able to correct what on our political side of the ledger feel like the wrongs of the Trump administration. I think it's good that we're not completely blind to the politics that are underneath anything and everything a president has to say, fortunately or unfortunately. By the way, let me see. Okay, we still got some time. Let's get one more clip from Biden. One of the big issues, so he's already said that the two biggest issues that he wants to address, the first one right off the bat is going to be COVID-19. I mean, that how we figure out how to vaccinate the country as quickly as possible. That is his number one concern. Second thing you mentioned is immigration reform. But for right now, I think that one of the biggest issues where there seems to be some kind of movement at the national level, but also at the state level, is about reopening schools. So this is again from the Lester Holt interview. This is Joe Biden on school reopenings and what it could cost us.
Takes a lot of money to get them back. The estimates are $150 to $200 billion for the year would take to get safely open our schools. For example, we know that we have to change everything from the ventilation systems in schools. We know we have to change the sanitary, we have to make sure the sanitary, everyone from sanitary workers right through to the bus drivers.
Okay, so it is going to be expensive, but right now there's more and more evidence. It's not conclusive because the data is so irregularly gotten, is the word from, let's say, like the Johns Hopkins Medical Center says that it's not a slam dunk, but there seems to be more and more evidence, at least at the grade school level, K through 5 or K through 8, that it isn't a big spreader of COVID. The problem is that not every school can afford the mitigation efforts that would be required to present the positive spin on COVID transmission. So I think he is addressing that issue straight on. I don't know if you've come, if you've given much thought to schools reopening. I know your daughter is out, you know, above high school age. My daughters are about a decade older than yours, so it doesn't maybe direct us immediately. But do you have any feeling one way or the other about the role of schools reopening?
Yeah, you know what? This is, like, so asinine. I cannot believe we're even talking about this. This is going backwards, right? You can't tell me that in Washington, 3,482 new cases in a single day, 35 deaths, right? This is exactly what we're talking about. Jay Inslee coming out and saying, hey, we may have cancer patients who won't be able to get treatment, or people with knee and hip replacement won't be able to go see the doctor. Like, this is what we're talking about. And then we're trying to, like, we're trying to appease everyone. So now we're like, on one hand, you're trying to appease these people. Then you turn around and you want to appease someone else because they have a business. And you have to appease these parents because they're tired of raising their kids. Newsflash, you have kids. It is what it is. It is not the school's job to raise your children. It never was. I know you got comfortable with it. It was always your job. When God gave them to you, it was your job to take care of them. But I just, you can't appease everyone. All of this was kind of foreseeable from the gate. And when I say that, I mean, when we first knew about COVID, we knew we needed to shut things down. And when we didn't, everything we're in right now was obvious. I know we want to blame Trump, but at the end of the day, we all play a role and a part in it. This was foreseeable. But schools, no. Let's not talk about
reopening. You are definitely not John Curley. John Curley thinks we should never have shut the schools or the bars or anything else. He is a purist as a libertarian on this front. It's refreshing for me to hear another perspective. By the way, what Dres was talking about, there is a draft now that suggests that we change the guidelines from to open schools from you need to have 75 cases per 100,000 residents to up to 200 cases per 100,000. That would allow about half of the 350 school districts in this state to reopen, as long as it keeps that transmission level. The problem is, though, that given that, it's still so bad, even with these new guidelines, it's so bad in Snohomish, King, and Pierce counties that even those lessened guidelines would not be enough to open up the schools in our district. Lots and lots more to talk about. Thank you, Dres. And now we're going to turn to the traffic. Tracy Taylor, is this like a holiday feel yet, or is it the day before the holiday for you? This hour of the Tom and Curley Show is brought to you by KeelMortgage.com. That's KeelMortgage.com, bringing you this 3 o'clock hour of a Wednesday edition that feels like Friday to me, pre-Thanksgiving show. My name is Tom Tangney. John Curley is actually taking the holiday off. Surprise, surprise, for a change. Good for him. And filling in, we've got Dres in for John. And I hope John is metaphorically turning over in his grave, hearing your response to the COVID-19 as opposed to his own response. He'll go, hey, I got to rush back to the show. I love it. So we have more. There's a lot. You know, it's fascinating because the holiday season, you tend to get distracted by the woes of the world or even the good things about the world because it becomes very family oriented. And I think that's definitely the case nonetheless. However, there are still a lot of issues going on because we're in this transition, a transition of an incumbent president who lost his chance for reelection. It doesn't happen that often. I think it's happened four times this century. So it's these kind of not uncharted waters, but uncomfortable waters, the relationship between Joe Biden and Donald Trump. Just recently, 2 days ago, I think, literally, the Trump administration and the GSA kind of acknowledged, even though the president hasn't conceded, that Joe Biden's indeed the apparent winner. I think he's officially the apparent winner at this point. He is the president-elect, and he will be getting a chance to go ahead and get the daily briefings that he should have been getting, I think, for the last 3 weeks. Anyway, what's interesting now is people are starting to look back at because I think we think the immediate crisis is resolved. I think that he may not go quietly into the, you know, that good night or something. But I think the president, no one thinks that Trump is going to, you know, hold himself up in the White House and insist that he won, that the transition looked like it's underway. So now people are beginning to look at, okay, what did the Trump administration kind of prove to us about our election system? Now, moderator of the VP debate, Susan Page, she works for USA Today. I saw her the other day talking about, she thinks that this just shows you how strong our political and electoral system is, that despite every effort on the president's part to overturn what appeared to be the results of the election, they were dealt with in the court and everything was resolved itself. No judges, you know, were convinced by the lack of evidence. That should reassure us that the system really works. However, we have this article by a guy named Alexander Burns in the New York Times that says just the opposite, that Trump really stress tested the election system, and now we have cracks showing that maybe need to be addressed.
I'm on the side of this article, right? Okay. I think our system has been exposed. The article basically calls Trump amateur hour, which I agree, right? In terms of, like, as a cheater, I'm from the hood, man. I know a cheater. I know good cheaters, right? I know people who specialize in trying to beat the system and go around it. Trump is a guy who just says something and then tries to prove it afterwards. He didn't really have a strategy because he didn't think he would lose. He just thinks he's so arrogant. He just figured, I can say what I want and people will follow me and I'll make it work and I'll bend the system to my will, right? He's rich, he's white, he's male, and he has so much privilege, and it has always worked for him some way, shape, form, or fashion. And so now he's in a position where when I look at the system, it doesn't look good. What happens when there's a guy who's really working on his cheating, right? Who's really trying to bend the system, who's really, this wasn't good. I found one of the most interesting things I found in this election, this post component, is just, it seemed like the people were like, wait, he can't do that. Wait, can he do that?
Yes.
How can he do that? Right? Yeah.
Exactly. What, and this is fascinating to me. And this is one of the things I think this article addresses. For instance, who knew that if you have county board canvassers, if they don't certify it for whatever reason, for partisan reasons, like in Michigan, they had two Democrats, they had two Republican, can't remember now if it's Wayne County, I think, board canvassers. If they didn't get one of those two Republicans to agree to what seemed evidence, you know, I mean, clear, that Biden had gotten more votes in that particular county, then it could throw a monkey wrench into the whole system. Who knew that if you don't have the county board canvassers acknowledging that, yes, indeed, my guy lost, that it could then be thrown to the legislature, and the legislature, if it happens to be in the loser's hands, could legitimately decide, oh, well, that wasn't a fair election. We now have the majority in the Michigan legislature. Even though we had 154,000 more people in Michigan voting for Biden, we can just determine that, well, we don't trust those numbers for no other reason than partisanship. I mean, there's nothing in the law that says they can't do that, perhaps. Then they could throw the election and you throw one state. Now, what this article points out is the reason this wasn't as effective as it might have been, the strategy, is because Trump more or less lost relatively big time. He says, imagine this was going back to the Gore, you know, Bush days when it came down to 527 votes in one particular state. This way, there were so many states and there was not any real evidence that even if that Biden had Michigan stolen from him, that wouldn't have been enough to throw the election. But still, it does show that we do not have lockdown procedures in hand that force a state whose electors are determined, you know, it seems like willy-nilly by precedent.
we all just went along to get along, and it takes a rabble rouser like Trump, somebody who is, I mean, I understand his appeal. A lot of people voted for him because he was going to be the bull in the China shop, yeah. And we just didn't like all the delicacy of the China shop. But it really does put stress on the weaknesses of our system. We could have an undemocratic result of an election this way.
It tells you that the system was built in these weird ways on decency, like someone conceding and doing it gracefully, yes, and doing it early, right? Then you get this guy with no class in place, and we're like, wait, what do we do? He didn't concede, and what are we gonna... But I will say this, everything you just said makes me feel like, you ever watched a boxing match and the match is over and you know who won? Some guy won 9 rounds, the other guy won 3, and they're taking all their time to count it up, and you're going, oh no, they're going to hose this guy. I can see it. They're going to hose him.
Yes.
I'm telling you, the American system feels like one day it's going to happen, right? Because all the pieces are in place, and it feels like there's a framework. When we start talking about systemic issues in this country, there's a framework in place, almost as if to say, because democracy is simple, and ours is complicated for some reason. It should be very simple. Majority wins. We've complicated it because we want to make sure at some point down the road, we're going to need to hose somebody. The powers that be are going to need to hose someone, and they're going to be able to through these types of
loopholes. To make too partisan an issue of this, but I can just point out, a lot of Democrats are feeling burned by the whole Electoral College business, because the Democrats have won the popular vote, 7 of the last 8 elections, except for the re-election of George Bush. That's the only one where the Democrats didn't have the popular majority, and yet 4 of those times it went to the Republican, I think. And by the way, here's just one line that I think is an interesting way to look at this. The gap between the complexity of the country's actual political system and the more rudimentary grasp most voters have of their government. It's true. Most of us don't know about the intricacies of the political process. We just want our guy to win, and so we would advocate for whatever would give our guy the win, because the guy we voted for would be better for America. And that's dangerous grounds to base a republic on. Okay, I hear the musical tones of Tracy Taylor, so let's check out the roads and see if people are getting ready for their Thanksgiving holiday. You're listening to the Tom and Curly Show. Tom Tangney here, John Curly taking the holiday off. Amazing. And Dre's filling in for him. Okay, we are going to, in this next few minutes, cover the waterfront metaphorically. We are taking a story that goes from Kitsap County to New York City, and that's about outdoor dining. It was all the rage this summer as a way to deal with COVID, that it's been established, there are a lot of questions about the COVID transmission, but it seems to be beyond dispute now that if you're outside, the chances of getting COVID are cut seriously. And so outdoor dining makes a lot of sense during the summer. Now that we're into the deep into the fall months and approaching winter, how is this going to work? Josh Farley in the Kitsap Sun wrote this cute story about all of these various businesses. The ingenuity of business owners, I heartily endorse here. Talking about bubbles, tents, and igloos, that there are in one particular place, the Boathouse in Kaysen, overlooking the North Bay of Case Inlet. They've got 5 transparent yurt-like tents where individuals can be encased in something that's see-through but plasticky as a way to keep outdoor dining available. I love another one. They mentioned the Tracyton Public House. They talk about, they have this huge outdoor TV that you can roll in and out for like the football games, and they market it as, quote, it's almost like being at the game with that open cold air. And I thought, that's really ingenious. But then the New York magazine looks at the open air restaurants that are hitting Manhattan, for instance, and Brooklyn, and they say, wait a minute. Basically, they're just, if it has walls and a roof, just because it's outdoors doesn't mean that it isn't a new building, and it's probably just as dangerous as anything indoors, since it's like indoor-outdoor dining. What's your take on all of this, this restaurant business, open air or not?
I like people being innovative, right? I'm boldly for small businesses and restaurants and things keep going. Let me say this. If you're in a box, you're in a box. I don't care if it's a classroom, a house, a work office, or a restaurant. A box is a box. Because it's plexiglass, doesn't make it not a box. Because you throw up windows in an outside area, but you've now enclosed people in a box, they're in a box. I want to extend that also to, because some people know I'm down in LA, right? And it's sunny out here. And so what I tend to see is people think because you're, this disease is airborne. And so at the end of the day, if you're, I go to Santa Monica sometimes and there's like 75 people all working out right in this little enclosed area. And I'm like, hey man, if it's airborne, you know, you can still inhale it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
If you're in close proximity. So I think we're losing some of the true kind of parameters to the disease. What I am in support of, though, are the pods or the igloos. Love them. Love them. Love them. Love them. Matter of fact, when I come to Seattle next time, it's all pods and igloos for me.
Yeah, I think the operating word, if there are only two sides to the wall, so there's, you know, it's there are two spaces on either side of you that are open, that also should be healthy because you can get a kind of a draft. They show one picture where it's like this completely open air. It's like a thing that's, it's like dining on a sidewalk, and you have like a roof over your head, but it's open to the air. So from that point of view, I think it's probably doable. But yeah, a lot of times it's sort of counterproductive, and people are shelling a lot of money out and not necessarily getting their money's worth if they get closed down. And I understand in L.A. they actually closed down outdoor dining despite the weather.
Yeah, womp, womp, womp.
Yeah, okay. I know, you got it bad in California. Come on home, Dre's. Okay, Tracy Taylor, what does it look like out on the roads right now?